load the plates and lift the weights, and we are mates, and weights are great. And as of late, we pontificate about the weights and make a podcast.
Sumo is cheating. This is Weekly Weights with Alex and Will.
Okay, welcome to episode 17 of Weekly Weights. I'm Will Berkman. With me is Alex Hayes. And with us is our special first international guest, Hani J. Zarelli. Have I said that correctly?
You did okay. Clearly you got some help from Alex ahead of time.
Got a bit of coaching.
Is it Hani J. Zarelli?
Yep.
That's the one.
Hani J. Zarelli.
So Hani is a coach at The Strength Athlete, which is an online coaching business which was started by Bryce Lewis. Was that in 2013 or 2014?
2014. Okay. It was early 2014, like January. I started in February.
So you started there in February?
Yes.
Okay. And Hani was my first coach, and I believe I was his first lifter to do a competition. Is that right?
Were you?
I think you told me that. Maybe you were lying.
You may have been. I mean, there have been many since.
Maybe you were lying to me.
Hey, beyond the pressure, no wonder he cooked.
I might have been. You were a very early client, relatively shit. But you know,
nothing's changed, mate. Times change. People don't. That's what they say.
It's fair. Yeah, you're not wrong.
Well, this has started off in shambles like most of our episodes.
Yeah, like so most of our episodes. Hani, I'd actually like to get a little bit more detail about you as a coach. So you are pretty well known amongst powerlifters. Did you have lifters at Worlds this year?
I did. Who did I have at Worlds this year? Garrett. I don't coach him directly, but I would call it consultation with Garrett. He mostly does his own thing at this point. Over time, our coaching relationship has kind of drifted, but that's more of an advisory role. But I was helping out Garrett Worlds. Another one of my lifters was meant to be there, but there were some complications with a drug test. Ooh. And I'd rather not call her out by name. I think that was it that I personally coach at Worlds this year.
You're also on the US national coaching team, correct?
Yes, I do. I've been an assistant coach for the US team for the past 3 years. You kind of have to put in your time as an assistant coach to be able to be, you know, eligible from a working standpoint to get a head coaching position. It's kind of like going through an internship at a company, right? You kind of have to put in your time as an assistant to learn the ropes. And so I've been doing that for the past 3 years, which has been a fun experience. I've gotten to travel around with the team a little bit, gotten to kind of rub elbows with some of the best powerlifting athletes in the world. You know, I get to just watch and see how people do things. And it's pretty cool. It's a fun opportunity to just watch and learn.
So what's your role on those trips?
Plate loader, mostly.
Yeah, Wilkes calls them flunkies. You're the guy who gets ordered about to make sure everything happens.
Yeah, I mean, over time, the role has increased. You know, the first year, it was basically I was a runner and a plate loader, and I was fine with that. You know, I got told that ahead of time. I don't really consider myself above any kind of work. And you know, and so that's what I did. It was, you know, what's the next load? 125. What's the next load? 175. And we would load them up and we would time the warmups, and that was what we were doing. And then this year we were handling athletes start to finish. And so the role expanded with time based on kind of building trust and rapport with the head coaches. And you know, I would say I probably have some pretty good trust and rapport with them.
Yeah, sure. I think you're being characteristically modest in describing your own achievements. So if quickly you could just rattle off maybe what the coaching achievements, like your highest coaching achievements or the ones you're most proud of are, and then your achievements as a lifter as well, we'll move on to actually quizzing you about the topic at hand today.
Okay. Well, as a lifter, I would consider myself in the upper middle tier. I'm not especially competitive from a national or an international standpoint. My best lifts in competition, I've squatted 265 kilos. I've benched 172.5, something like that. And I've deadlifted 295.
And at what body weight's that?
Those were all right around 99 kilos or right. so.
Okay. Give so or take a little bit. Pretty impressive lifts. And as a coach?
As a coach, it's hard to pinpoint one thing as being my, you know, my biggest coaching achievement, right? Because it's I am very much of the camp that I don't think that a coach is entirely responsible for an athlete's success. And I think that that's one of the biggest problems in the coaching industry, is that so many people like to take personal credit for the achievements of others. And I actually try to distance myself from that. If I had to isolate one thing that brought me the most joy, I coached a guy for about a year who was a sub junior when we started, 17. And, you know, I coached him up to US Nationals, and then he won US Nationals, went on to Worlds, totally shit the bed at Worlds. But, He actually ended up getting offered a full ride scholarship for a powerlifting program at a university in the Midwest in the US. So that ended up being something like $52,000 a year in scholarship money by way of his powerlifting achievements. And that, you know, that's a life changing thing. That's a $200,000 scholarship. And, you know, while that wasn't my doing, I was some small piece in that gigantic achievement. And so that to date is probably the most fulfilling thing that I've ever been a part of from a lifting standpoint. You know, individual PRs, big lifts at competitions, those are all cool, right? But when it comes down to it, I like to coach what I call the complete athlete. And so if I can help people to do things that are actually helpful in their real life, I feel much more fulfilled by my work.
Very cool.
Yeah, very cool.
So I think that's a pretty good start.
Yeah.
We'll go on to what we've sort of planned to talk about with you. So Will and I often on the podcast talk a lot about our relationships with our clients and how we move from a more generalized plan to a more individualized plan as we get to know the lifter a little bit more. So how much individual difference do you think there is from lifter to lifter?
Less than people make it out to be, you know? I think, and actually, you know what, as a case study here for this, we have a free program on our website, right, that Eric Bodhorn and I co-authored 3 years ago now or something. And it's a 9 week long generalized program. It's moderate frequency, moderate to slightly on the upper moderate level of volume, and a high level or relatively high level of specificity. And at this point, there's probably a few thousand people who've run that program and seen results from it, and a small percentage of people who haven't. And so just as a case study, you know, in general, that program works for people. And so long as they fall within the target demographic, which is novices to, well, upper level novices to upper middle intermediates. So I would say just from that alone, you know, without looking into my own experience and my own bias, because obviously individualization of programming is kind of what I sell, right? But without looking any further, on the surface, if you're an athlete who doesn't have any injuries to deal with, who doesn't have any specific limitations, or doesn't have a really weird build, like Alex, for example, has a really weird build, and so his training has to be kind of specially catered to him. But if you don't fall into those categories, then generally you'll respond to something reasonably templated. I think the big differences are recovery related. I think that, you know, if you're the kind of person who just recovers extremely slowly from deadlifts, or maybe you have, you know, some kind of injury that limits you from recovering on your bench press or on your squats, then you have to get into individualization. But I think that by and large, at least at the start of training, you know, if I have someone who has been squatting twice a week and it's a second person who's been doing the same, then I'm probably going to start them in the same place when I create a new program for them and adjust it based on how they respond.
Yeah, sure. Just to sort of extend that, the case study of the generalized intermediate program. So you've said that, you know, the majority of athletes respond to that program positively. In terms of the magnitude of response, how much difference do you think you see from person to person?
Oh, that's gigantic. I have seen people who, and a surprising amount of people who have actually run it and put, you know, 40, 50 kilos on their total in 9 weeks, which is, says to me that they're testing before the program was bad more than anything, you know, that they hadn't tested their lifts in a while, or that they hadn't been training with a specific program. And, you know, whatever the reason, I think probably at least half of those people, they, they didn't really have an opportunity to refine their technique and really test their lifts appropriately beforehand. And so I think that, but again, you can make an argument for technical mastery being an important component of training. And so had they not run the program, they wouldn't have done that and they wouldn't have seen that increase. So is it because of the program? Yes, but no, but yes.
Yeah, sure.
But also I've seen people who, you know, have run it back to back to back. And every time it's a 5 pound PR or, you know, a 2.5 kilo PR, forgive me, I'm trying to stay in kilos since I know this is an Aussie podcast,
right,
but every time
two by two,
some are more numerate
than others, but yeah, go on.
I'm trying not to be disingenuous as a foreigner with a seductive accent on your podcast. I'm trying not to be.
Just aware that you're wrong.
At this point, I speak kilos and pounds.
You know what I hate is when American lifters lift in kilo plates and then say their lifts in pounds, like in competition.
At least they say the appropriate load. It's
like, pardon me? Sorry, what did you say?
A lot of them say the appropriate load, right? So, you know, people say 265 kilo or 584 pounds.
Yeah.
And so most people are good about that.
Yeah, so it
bothers me when people say.
I think you should use the unit that lets you get to the nearest milestone. Because, like, you know, a 227 kilo squat is, like, okay. But when you say 500 pounds, it sounds really good. You know, but then I'm trying to think of the reverse. Like a 300 kilo deadlift is what, like 660 pounds. Like it still sounds good in pounds, but it doesn't sound like a milestone. You know. Anyway, I think we're getting off topic. You were saying that certain people get a really massive response to this generalized program. Certain people get a more consistent but smaller one over time. The other thing, the sort of next question, which is maybe more hypothetical again, is what would you expect to see as a difference, like? You know, say you took a high responder to the generalized program, how much more response do you think they would get from a perfectly individualized approach as opposed to just the generalized one?
You know, that's a good question, but it's a hard one to answer.
Yeah.
I almost think that sometimes people would respond less to that sometimes, because of the fact that when you start to get into like the minutiae of adjusting programs, and the more programs I write, the more that I agree with this. When you start to get into the minutiae of adjusting programs, and especially with, you know, the kind of people who or a lot of the people who sign up for weekly programming are highly analytical and, you know, want to talk about why we're making the changes and want to talk about what's going into the programming, which is awesome by all means. But in that, you know, they overthink, and sometimes they can get you as the coach to overthink. And so you start to think too deeply into why you're making this change. And it's just that they're stimulating kind of the processes in your mind that you make decisions with. And, you know, it's all algorithmic, right? It's like, yeah, you start with A and then did B or C happen? And then based on that, you choose either D or E or F or G, you know, right? I would say in general, as a rule, an individualized program that's more targeting their specific weaknesses. Let's say that they have some specific technical issues or specific individual muscular weaknesses that need to be addressed or injuries that need to be avoided or rehabilitated. I think those are more cases where individualization of programming is valuable, or leading into a competition, managing fatigue can be one of the most valuable pieces of an individualized program, because week over week we can see how you're responding, and, you know, we can try to avoid making hair trigger changes, or we can, you know, make the changes as needed as we go. But for your just average upper intermediate highly, or let's say high level of technical mastery lifter who doesn't have any injuries, the results might be similar.
Yeah.
Might be surprisingly similar, which is probably a disappointing answer to hear for people who sell coaching, but it's, you know, but you can also only run the templated program so many times, right? Eventually you're going to need some new stimulus. And so at that point, that's kind of where the individualization comes in.
Yeah. I guess this is just a thought bubble I had listening to you just then. I guess part of the role of coaching or individualization is actually is managing at the macro level rather than the micro one. So getting a lifter and saying, like, you know, we've got a couple of important competitions coming up at these times. And so while they might need a similar programming approach to fill the space, it's figuring out when to enter a certain phase or focus on certain things, or identifying when to work on a given weakness, as opposed to really getting into the minutiae week by week, except for just sort of managing so that you keep them ticking along. And part of my thinking for that is because when you look at the, when you look at each lift, in general, amongst, you know, people who are technically competent, say, you know, the sticking points are similar in the squat, the sticking points are similar in the bench, and they're similar in the deadlift usually, for raw lifters. And so it's sort of like they have relatively similar needs developmentally. It's more just, or like, you know, for performance, it's more just like, how are we going to structure their training longer term to keep them developing and having them performing well at the times they need it? And I guess that's part of the role of coaching, is not so much getting in there and making changes set by set, day by day, week by week, all the time. What do you think of that?
Yeah, absolutely. I completely agree with that. And, you know, one of the things that I am a proponent of that is a little bit counterintuitive, especially in what is a world of everybody wants everything instantly. You know, I have a couple of clients who have started coaching, and I mean, they just made a stupid amount of progress super fast, and they're outliers. You know, I wouldn't say that my coaching does that for everybody, because that would be a lie. But the, you know, I've had, you just by nature of having coached several hundred people, I have had a few people who have been hyper responders, and, you know, to the point where I said, you know what, we're making progress too fast. Your training loads are going to go up too quickly and you're going to get hurt here. And so I've actually scaled back their training for a block or for a couple of weeks because of the fact that I don't want them to go from, you know, from their 80% being one number to their 80% being 50 pounds or 25 kilos higher than that in a matter of 8 weeks, because of the fact that, you know, sure, they're capable of handling that, but they haven't really worked up to it. And if we just jump right into that, I would bet my money that, you know, they're going to end up hurting themselves, if not in the short term, in the long term, because of the changes in that. And they haven't had an opportunity to build up kind of what I would call structural resilience to that.
I guess, sorry, this is another thought bubble that I just had then. Part, like, the more programs I write for athletes and the more people I coach, the more I start to think of, you know, of training as more just being sort of a stimulus to provoke a response, rather than, you know, like 80% necessarily inducing the same response athlete to athlete. Like, if you get 50 pounds of gain out of somebody from them squatting, whatever it is, you know, 150 pounds for sets of five, going to doing 155 or 160 pounds for sets of five is still likely going to be enough stimulus to provoke change. It might not provoke 50 pounds of change, and the relative intensity is obviously fallen relative to their capability, but if it's still enough stimulus to provoke change, it doesn't necessarily have to accelerate in difficulty at the same rate at which the client themselves is progressing. Does that make sense to you?
Yeah, absolutely. And I agree with that wholeheartedly. That's kind of what I'm saying. It sometimes don't necessarily equate someone's training max to their proper one rep max, because I want to scale back the intensities that they're using in training because I don't want them to overwork themselves. It doesn't really do us a lot of good to make a bunch of progress really fast just to undo it in the subsequent block.
Yeah, sure. Well, that all rings true to me as well. Alex, do you have something to say?
So what parameters of the athlete's response or programming seem to differ the most in your experience?
Probably frequency. And, you know, the more programs I write, the more people end up doing squatting twice, benching three times, and deadlifting once, mostly with men. And then women, you could basically add plus one to those frequencies. And I would say those are the most common. I think I probably have, or in my opinion, you know, and this is barring injury, right? I'm talking non-injured athletes and non-physically limited athletes. I have a couple athletes I coach who've had shoulder surgery or who have had surgery in their hip or have had a history of knee issues because they played basketball for years. And so we have to make little tweaks for things like that. But for the most part, within the context of the average people, I would say that, you know, the biggest differences in frequency are going to be gender related. And that's just by nature of the fact that typically females, because their maxes are so much lower relative to their body weight, those lifts are more recoverable. You know, just like you can throw 95% for sets of five at some women for their benches and they can do it, you know, and you give that to a male and they're going to get one and call you crazy. And that's just kind of the nature of it. So it really varies, and I make adjustments as we go. I like to follow the kind of the simple guidelines that if you're training at a certain frequency, you're recovering well, you're progressing slowly, then you can add volume, right? And you can add volume in a number of different ways. You can add volume by adding additional sets, but if you add additional sets and you're still progressing slowly, then maybe it's time to add an additional instance of frequency. Maybe it's time to go from squatting twice to three times a week. Or if you're having trouble with technical mastery and you find that from session to session, squats feel foreign or bench feels foreign, then adding another day of frequency gives you another opportunity to practice. You're going to feel less foreign session to session. And interestingly enough, you're going to, the more frequently you do the lifts, this is just anecdotal, there's no evidence behind this, and I don't necessarily recommend trying this, but you'll find that you get through your warm-ups in a more efficient manner. You just feel more ready to perform the lift session to session just by performing it more frequently. And so that's just a byproduct of the specific technical development that you're going through by performing that lift more often.
Yeah,
I definitely agree with that. Do you have any indicators that might give you a clue about anything that needs changing?
Like, let's talk specifically with frequency. So you said like recoverability session to session. But do you, are there, yeah, maybe athlete traits, say, that would indicate to you maybe you would start at the lower end of that frequency beyond just gender?
Max, general, or generally, you know, let me choose a different word there. How strong they are. So very, very strong athletes, I'm typically going to take in the lower range of frequencies because of the fact that those loads are just so high. Or if they want to train with a higher frequency, I'm using some very self-limiting variations. You know, if I have a low bar squatter that can squat 700 pounds, I'm not having them do heavy low bar squats 2 days a week, 3 days a week. I'll have them do, you know, I'll have them have an appropriate competition squat day 1 day a week that is, you know, has appropriate relative intensities for the rep ranges that we're working in. But the secondary days are going to be, you know, high bar squats or paused high bar squats or safety bar squats or beltless squats or some kind of variation that that forcefully limits the load they can put on the bar, because, you know, they can put more load on that movement pattern by, you know, throwing on a belt, throwing on knee sleeves, moving the bar down on their back. But that's not the intention. The intention isn't to do as much as possible in every session. I wholeheartedly disagree with training programs that take that approach because of the fact that they're unsustainable. And sure, you can make a bunch of progress really fast, but you're gonna get hurt, period. And I will stand by that statement. But because I've seen it happen, you know, a number of times to myself, to others, to people that I coached early on before I had developed more of a conservative mindset, it just happens. And so I think having a healthy balance based on, you know, how strong you are. So very strong athletes take a slightly more conservative approach, focus more on building volume in a general movement pattern. I think that, you know, you can get a little more specific as you get closer to competitions. But at that point, I start actually fixing loads on the lays that I intend to be lighter. You know, I'll have a day that's a fixed competition squat day. And then if I have a secondary day that's paused squats, that's meant to be low bar paused with a belt and everything, you know, if I let that person run wild, they're going to work themselves into the ground on the day that's intended to be easier. And so I've started actually fixing the loads on those secondary days because I don't want them, I want them to walk out of the session and say, wow, that was easy. That's the intention. It's meant to be easy. It's meant to grease the groove and get you ready for your heavier training session later in the week. And I think if people took a more thoughtful approach to training like that, they would do better. But for the people who are a little bit on the weaker end of the spectrum, again, because they can recover from their lifts better, they, you know, you can add more frequency, or you can adjust that based on the fact that they are responding well, and you can distribute it that way.
What about, so say somebody's struggling to recover from however many, you know, squatting 2 or 3 days a week. Is there a point at which you would, instead of just reducing the difficulty of the second exposure, you would remove it? Is there a specific time you might do that?
In terms of reducing frequency like that, very, very extremely rarely do I have an athlete that squat less than twice a week. I happen to think that twice is kind of the sweet spot for men, but I could probably count on my fingers the number of times that I've had athletes do that, and it might even be just the fingers of one hand. I can't even think of someone offhand that I have squat once a week. Injury would be the number one, you know, because sometimes you just need that recovery between sessions. Or for an athlete who has a secondary sport they're pursuing, right? I coach some people who, Alex, you were one of them. I have another guy now who's a 700-pound squatter that likes to play basketball for 4 months of the year. And you know, he wants to play basketball. It is what it is. I'm going to cater to his lifestyle choice. And
how's his vertical, just out of curiosity?
It's about 40 inches.
Fuck me.
That's really good, isn't it?
Yeah.
Yeah, that's about four inches, quite good.
So, that's about a meter. It's about a meter and some change.
It's over, yeah. It's like 107 or something.
Shit. Okay.
Yeah, yeah, it's pretty high. And for perspective, he weighs about 115 kilos.
Is he the guy who lifted on the weekend?
Yes.
On Sunday?
Yeah, that
Did
guy.
Did you see that guy?
No.
Fuck me.
Yeah, he's pretty strong. He crossed over from the USPA drug tested side to try out USA Powerlifting. I'm hoping he wants to go to Raw Nationals. Well, I know he wants to go. I'm hoping he actually goes. With Dennis Cornelius moving up to super heavyweights, he has a very serious shot at winning the 120 kilo class, both domestically and internationally. So
what was his total? 840.
847.5, but we didn't take a third deadlift because he had a blood blister in his hand.
Oh, okay. And I did see your deadlift video, I think, of this guy.
And his squat was easy.
Yeah, yeah. He's kind of one of those lifters that goes from easy to miss.
Yeah, okay.
But there was about 12 and a half kilos left on that squat or so, maybe a little more.
So this bloke is, he only squats once a week so that he can play ball.
No. I would consider reducing his training if so. Okay. But
it
was that we originally reduced the intensity of one of the days to take some stress off his knees, and then had that not worked, I would have considered switching to one time per week frequency. But that ended up working. You know, it ended up being that we had one session that was far removed from the basketball day that was the higher demand training session, and then one day that was a little less demanding either before or after his sport training.
Cool.
Interesting. How do you go about making changes to an athlete's program over time, and do you think that a like athlete's response can change over the course of their career? Like, could they at one point respond well to high frequency and then at another point respond well to low frequency type of thing?
Yes, absolutely. I think that. And repeat the first question. Sorry.
The first question was, how do you go about making changes to an athlete's program over time? So is it sort of like a gently, gently, softly, softly thing, or do you, you know, just go from once a week to twice a week frequency, say on the squat, you know, with a given amount of volume on both days?
I think once a week to twice a week is a bit of a gentle change.
Yeah.
That's a bad example. I think you gave a gentle example as the counterpoint to gentle changes.
Yeah, sure.
So going from once a week to four times a week would be an example of a non-gentle change.
Yeah.
And I would never do that. For a number of reasons, mostly because of adaptation and the fact that doing something like that is typically a way to get hurt. There's a general theme in how I make decisions. It's how can we do more without getting hurt, right? Because you can ask any power lifter and it's like, what do you think has hindered you the most in your lifting career? What stopped you from making progress? And getting hurt is the answer for probably 97% of people.
Yeah, not actually being able to train.
Yeah.
Right, exactly. Training, it's limitation.
Makes you better, right?
Yeah, exactly. It's this circle, right? It's like, okay, I'm not making progress. I need to train more. Oh, I trained more and now I got hurt. And now because I'm hurt, I'm not making progress. But now I need to train more, but I got hurt again. And so at a certain point, you have to break
the circle.
That.
Yeah, higher, yeah, higher for the, yeah, the one crazy secret.
Yeah, this one crazy secret. No, it's no secret. It's just, it's the answer isn't always doing a lot more. Sometimes it can be more, but with an asterisk next to it in terms of how you do it. You change the movements, you adjust how you do it. Going back to that athlete I coach on the weekend, when he first started with me, he had tremendously bad knee tendonitis, and now he squats above 650 pounds, or he's squatting 300 kilos and above twice a week. And with no problems at all for substantial volume, and doing pause deadlifts with, you know, up to 350 kilos for repetitions in the gym. And he doesn't have any of those issues anymore because we took a thoughtful approach to his training and built it in a way that was conducive to his recovery and allowed him to not get hurt. And so, you know, sometimes you just have to make those micro adjustments, like, okay, if we take this day and we make it lower volume, and then we take that one day and we make it a little higher volume, so you have that higher stimulus day, but then you have that recovery promoting day, all of a sudden you can do more volume in total. But one of those days is just meant to be easy and just meant to promote your recovery and get your blood flow and grease that groove a little bit. And now all of a sudden, wow, I can recover so much better.
Yeah, it's something that I'm sort of hearing in the theme of your responses is something Alex and I have spoken about, which is that the distribution of your work in a training program should be done thoughtfully, sort of with a mind to having you performing well on the days that are meant to be harder or where it's asking more of your performance, then have your easy days be sufficiently easy so that, you know, you recover, or if it's a technique day, you actually practice good technique and so on. So you distribute the work so that you actually perform the work how you want it to be performed.
Yes, exactly. And you know, sometimes you swing and miss, right? That's the nature of training. There's so many variables going on during the week, stress at work, how you ate, how you slept, all those things can affect how you feel on Saturday. Mm-hmm. And so typically Friday, Saturday, Sunday, people like to do their heavier sessions on the weekend. They have more time, which doesn't make sense to me, right? If I was going to spend a bunch of time in the gym, I want to do it on like Monday night when I have nothing to do. But I like to spend my Saturdays out of the gym. But it's funny how my mentality has changed over the years. I'm such a crotchety old man now. But it is what it is.
To the listeners, you should see his hair. It's thinning.
Yeah,
you showed us before.
It is. My hair is not thinning. Just for clarity.
Is that a toupee?
It's not thin hair.
Is that you're wearing?
Yeah, there has to be hair for it to thin.
Sorry, were you still going on your response there?
I don't remember what I was saying. I lost track. I couldn't hear you through all of my hair, you know. was covering my ears.
The second part of Alex's question was, over the course of people's training career, do you ever observe people who go from, you know, responding best to very high volumes or frequencies to the other end of the spectrum? So say Alex tends to respond to lower volume and, you know, lower frequency of hard deadlift sessions. Could you see a time during his lifting career where the opposite might be true?
Potentially. I kind of look at changes like that as tools in the toolbox. People typically have a frequency where they can train and thrive. And that's not to say that it won't change slightly over time, but I don't think someone who, you know, for example, using the deadlifts, Alex, you like to deadlift heavily once per week typically, right? Because you know.
Yeah, I don't think he rarely gets above a, you know, last warm-up or maybe even an opener at most in his whole training cycle. So his heavy is, right, you know, heavy with limitations.
You can guess where he learned that, but that's exactly how I write training programs typically. But I've gotten a little more aggressive in recent years, but not much. If you were to take Alex and give him 4 times a week deadlifts that were super low intensity, right? Now, number one, that would be terrible, but I don't think that would be ideal for him because of the fact that no doubt you've played with higher frequency deadlifts previously, twice, maybe even 3 times a week. And there's a reason that you use once a week. It's because you respond better to that, you recover better to that. And sometimes there's a trade-off with that, right? If you were to start deadlifting 4 days a week, your squats would suffer. Mm-hmm. Your back would be so fried all week long, your bench would suffer. You would feel worse outside of the gym. Your lifestyle would suffer. And so... is there a time where that can happen and maybe you need that as an intervention? Maybe your deadlift has been stalled for 6 months and so you want to try something extreme? Sure. I wouldn't necessarily jump to something like that. I would probably just make a change short term. And if it continues to work, then maybe we continue rolling with that. But you very rarely see someone go from one side of the spectrum to the other in my experience. Again, unless they get better from an injury that they had previously, right? But that's kind of an asterisk answer to that question. It's not necessarily the case that you're asking about.
Yeah, sure. You'll have to excuse me. I completely forgot the name of the podcast. I listened to it when I was on holidays. But you were talking about experimenting with emerging strategies, which is something I think Mike Teixeira, whose name I also probably mispronounced.
Yeah, that was right.
That was correct.
That was right. That was on point.
Yeah. So you were discussing that on another podcast. And I believe the concept is sort of using the athlete's response to training to guide the changes that you make to training. But could you sort of give a slightly better explanation than that and, you know, explain the implications for that in writing programs?
Sure. The emerging strategy is interesting because it's the logic that we all use to dictate how we make training changes and how we don't make training changes. It's the same things that a lot of coaches are applying. It's just systematized.
Right.
So the gist of it is that you start with some kind of generalized approach with a certain amount of frequency. And based on that, you run for, you know, you it's all rating of perceived exertion based. And I'm talking specifically about my experience with this working with Mike in the RTS style. So this is his idea, so all credit to him. But you start with this frequency, these ratings of perceived exertion in your training, and every day you work up to some top set on each movement, and you repeat that a number of times, and then move on to your next movement. And so the concept is that you start with 1 week of training, and you repeat that week until your performance doesn't go up. So, you know, usually that's somewhere between 3 and 6 weeks that you can repeat it before your performance stops going up. And then you have what's called the transition period, where you switch into a different style of training. You do some lighter, higher rep stuff, and then you jump into another training block. And the idea of the emerging strategies approach is that you try out several different training weeks that you repeat, and you find the ones in the history that you have of your training that you respond best to. And then when it comes to preparing for a meet, you can look back at your long history of training, because this is a very data-driven approach. You can look back at your long history of training and say, all right, my bench responded best when I did this, this, and this. My squat responded best when I did this, this, and this. And my deadlift responded best when I did this and this. And then you take those, you create what would be the newer, better training week based on all of your previous best responses. And you run that for the number of weeks that you typically ramp up before the competition. This is based on a few assumptions. Number one, it's based on the assumption that you're going to continue to ramp up for the same length of weeks. It's what Mike calls length to peak, or time to peak. For some people, it's very short. For other people, they can run the same thing for 7-8 weeks and build upon it the whole time. And, you know, there's no deload involved. The idea is that you train directly into the week of the meet. You know, your performance based on history should be highest in week 5. So you start that optimized training week 5 weeks out. And so it's really just accurately logging what your performance changes were based on your training for an extended period of time. And then when it comes time to decide on a training block to use to work into testing or to work into a competition, you simply use the historical data of what you responded to best before to dictate what you're going to do up to that point. I mean, it's quite logical, really. It's the same sort of decision we make. It's just the concept of time to peak is something that's unique to emerging strategies more than anything, I think.
Yeah, it seems... Sorry, I'm trying to wrap my head around it. I think I get it. It seems one of the big changes is that rather than sort of arbitrarily deciding how long you'll dedicate to a given block or how long you'll train a quality for or when you'll impose a taper or something, you're using, yeah, the history of athlete response to make decisions based on make your phasic structure decisions. Is that exactly?
Exactly. And there's you're not necessarily looking at standard volume and intensity phases. Pretty much you're working hard all the time.
Right. Alex, you had a question.
What would you say are the disadvantages of this strategy?
Mentally, more than anything, for an athlete, you don't get to expect to feel better on meet day. But I almost think, and until you've worked with an athlete a few times and know exactly how they taper, it's hard to say how people are going to perform. Some people don't need a taper at all. You know, a lot of women don't need tapers at all. More and more I find myself not tapering people's bench regardless of gender. Or at least very slightly tapering it down. But you know, something that athletes who are working their asses off in an intensity phase look forward to is the fact that, okay, this is the worst of it. It doesn't feel any worse than this. This week I expect to recover. This week I'm going to sleep extra. I'm going to make sure I get all my calories in. I'm going to do some active recovery stuff, and on Saturday I'm going to feel fantastic. And that's something that it's kind of like part of the mental buy-in to your training cycle, right? It's like, oh, okay, I feel like crap now, but there's a purpose behind this. That's probably my biggest gripe with it, but that's more, you know, do you care more about how you feel or do you care more about how you perform? It's hard to say at this point whether it's a superior or inferior training strategy, because the whole idea is relatively new. And, you know, I'm sure once Mike has data to display what the training results have been like, he will probably present that in some sort of organized manner for people to look at and to examine and to understand. My suspicion is that it's going to be fairly similar to other training approaches. It's that you're going to have some high responding athletes, you're going to have some not high responding athletes, and it's going to end up being probably, if it's going to be better, I wouldn't expect it to be a huge margin. I would be surprised by that. simply because it's, I mean, like I said, it's very intuitive. It's just that you take what worked for you before, and when you want to work towards your most important competition or most important test, you use what worked previously. And I do this for some of my clients. I've had guys who they had a killer training block during their off season, and I said, all right, we're going to try something weird. I'm going to have you do this exact same training block leading into your meet. And it works. It definitely works. Does it work because it's that training block's magical, or does it work just because they're stronger? It's hard to say.
There's two things I find a tiny bit dissatisfying about the idea, and I'm going to find it really hard to express them because I'm still sort of wrapping my head around it myself. But one, this isn't necessarily a criticism of the idea, but one is that I guess if you have sort of a scientific training or you've studied physiology, you can sometimes approach training as sort of thinking that certain training parameters or certain training arrangements induce specific adaptations. And so you want to approach powerlifting competition with, certain specific adaptations maximized. So you might think that handling heavy loads is necessary for preparing somebody to handle their heaviest loads on competition day, and you get specific nervous system adaptations to handling weights above X or Y percentage. And so trying to sort of gel, because I guess if you observe in somebody a response that, they improve, their 1RM improves when they handle loads mostly at 70%, ergo they should handle loads at mostly 70%, that kind of makes sense. But at the same time, it is difficult to reconcile that with a broad body of observation that, in general people respond best to X and Y. So I guess, yeah, that's number one. And then number two idea that I'd like you to respond to is that...
Let me interrupt you and respond to your idea first. Yeah. I think your counterexample, you gave a specific example of someone who is an out-of-the-norm responder and compared it to a generalization.
Yes.
So I think that's kind of where the failure to connect is there, and that's why your example doesn't work, right? So the general concept is that people should handle heavier loads in training, and that they should work in lower repetitions to get those neurological adaptations to prepare themselves. And a lot of what people are doing in emerging strategies is just that.
Yeah.
They're working up to singles. They're performing heavy singles in their training. They're working in those percentages, and they're doing a lot of the same things. Mm-hmm. It's that there's a higher degree of variety in the training typically, and that there's not typically a standard training taper. Those are the differences. But it's the example of someone who responds best to 70% in training, that would kind of reveal itself in the data.
Right.
They would realize with their approach that these RPEs are beating this person up, their performance goes down when they train this hard, and it would naturally adjust for that because of the bank of history that you have. So the whole concept hinges on the fact that you need to be doing it for a while to have an understanding of your training response effectively. So with a short history of training data, would it be much harder to effectively utilize that strategy? Absolutely. And I think that's more of where that challenge arises for you, this specific example.
Yeah.
But I think naturally the idea here is that the whole point of coaching is that we individualize to the response of the athlete, and we don't try to individualize the athlete to fit into our coaching. We individualize our coaching to fit onto the athlete. And, or at least that's what I'm doing. But I see your logic, but the more important thing here is that in order for a data driven approach to work, there has to be data.
Yeah. I think you've answered the criticism really well. I guess more what I was saying is dissatisfying about it is I almost want to know why it is that certain people would respond differently when we have like a generalized model that kind of explains training responses on a person by person basis. And so it's sort of like, to make longer term inferences, you kind of want to know the why of, you don't just want to know the pattern you observe, you kind of want to know the why. And one of the nice things about, that physiological, I guess, school of thought is that you think, well, this is why people respond to X and Y, and so we want to structure it like that. When the data doesn't support that, it's sort of like, it says that you should train slightly differently because that's how people respond better, but I want to know why. And I guess,
yeah,
it's not a fault of the model that it can't explain that, but it is sort of, gnaws at me.
Once a couple hundred or a few thousand people have been through that model, then, I know Mike keeps all the data, and I know that he will probably look back and examine it and probably profile all the athletes and see who responded to what and try to figure out why. You know, he is an extremely cerebral man. Mm-hmm. And so he will no doubt try to figure that out. But yeah, the why is the eternal question. What, right? We all want to know why. If someone knew why, they would be writing better training approaches than the rest of us, and we'd all be out of a job. Yeah. But so it's hard to say. I wish I had that answer.
And the second thing that, again, isn't quite a criticism, but it's something I want to ask is, if you observe certain patterns to, say, a training week, again, one of the concepts that we often think about in terms of writing training programs is thinking in terms of phasic structure, or in terms of planning for the long term so that you get a greater performance down the track. So within the data that you collect with emerging strategies, do you start to look for long-term patterns of sequencing that result in a better response down the track? Or is the assumption that sort of a given training week will continue to promote adaptation indefinitely?
The sequencing is something that is considered as well. So, you know, for example, when we ran 4 weeks of these exercises together prior to 4 weeks of these exercises together, we noticed that your performance went up for this lift in this amount of time by this week. That is a component of it as well. To be completely honest with you, the ins and outs of it, like the specifics, I was working with Mike for a short period of time for my own training because I wanted to learn about it, quite frankly. I wasn't able to do it for long enough because I started doing Brazilian Jiu-Jitsu about 5 weeks into that, or 6 weeks into that. As you can imagine, that extremely high volume training with Jiu-Jitsu it's hard to manage. Yeah. But, the sequencing is a consideration. I've had this conversation with Mike for sure.
I'd be thrilled. We'd be thrilled to talk to Mike about it at some stage because it is a very interesting concept, and it sort of builds on but upends a lot of the things that we think about normally, like just in general training dogma. So it's really cool.
I believe they are in Vienna right now at Das Gym giving a seminar, or were.
Oh, Vienna, and that's in Austria. G'day, mate.
Yeah. Put another shrimp on the barbie, right? But you know your Dumb and Dumber references. I didn't know you guys watch movies
Dumb
down
and Dumber,
under.
Alex and I.
Dumber. Yeah. I believe that you, Alex, you look like Harry Dunn's character.
Yeah, go on.
I believe, and I hope I'm not saying something that's supposed to be private information, but I believe Mike is supposed to be releasing a book on emerging strategies.
Weights episode 17. You heard it here first.
Yeah, Weekly Weights 10 for a discount.
you can ask Mike about that. But I think it might be worth purchasing that, and I'm sure there will be pirated copies, but I'm all for purchasing stuff from people who really put time and effort into it. And I've actually gotten a pirated book before. I'd read it, and then I went and bought it because I thought that it was good information, and I wanted the author to be paid for that.
In the States, do you have those ads like at the start of movies? We used to have them at the start of our old VCR tapes. They'd say like, you wouldn't steal a car, you wouldn't steal whatever it is, like your neighbor's baby. Why would you steal a movie?
Now they just give you an anti-piracy warning on DVDs.
Yeah.
But who buys DVDs anymore? You can literally go on the Amazon app on your TV and watch whatever you want for $1.99. You know, why would anybody not do that?
Yeah.
We don't have Amazon.
No, we don't even have Amazon in Australia. We're a backup.
Oh, man.
Man, they turn the internet off here like between 12 and 3 a.m., just to give it a rest.
You're a liar. I know a lie when I hear one. But
we definitely don't have Amazon though.
No, we don't have Amazon.
That's unfortunate. But you know what? That might be a good thing. Amazon is slowly killing small business here because – what was that?
Are they buying the NFL?
I wouldn't be surprised. They're slowly buying all sorts of things. And their market cap now is so – they're crazy big. And their stock price is, I think, like $1,400 a share. And that's American money. So that's like 3,000 Australian, right?
Oh, 13,000.
2,000.
I know. But yeah, Yeah, Amazon is, it's a crazy company. You guys should look forward to that coming in. I can literally order whatever I want, and in a lot of cases, it can be on my door the next morning. It's insane.
Americans,
yeah, crazy. All right, we're going to take a really quick break, and then we'll come right back and just chat a tiny bit more.
Welcome back to Weekly Weights. This is episode 17. I'm Alex Hayes here with Will Berkman, and with us is Hannah Giazzarelli. We're going to move on to talking about a hypothetical lifter. So let's take this lifter who has different abilities across the three power lifts. So let's say he's an intermediate squatter, a relatively bad bencher, and a pretty good deadlifter. So someone who might do 220 squat, 110 bench, 280 deadlift at 83. First question, how do you program the lifts differently in light of the differences in their development?
So for this lifter, I could tell you right offhand, high frequency bench, moderate frequency squat with higher volume and low frequency deadlift, for a couple of reasons, and volume would be variable. It would be based on what they recover from in the deadlift. Just because this case study is something you see not infrequently, actually. It's probably the most common example of a specifically unusual lifter, like you, Alex.
The Will Berkman.
Yeah, this is me.
Oh. Oh, okay. I was thinking yeah. It was the Alex Hayes.
Better at squat, better at deads, worse at bench.
For sure. that's fine. I have an athlete from Australia actually who squats 250, pulls about 300, and his bench is about 120.
Is that JP Couchy?
No, that's a laugh. No. He's more of a low key guy.
Yeah, but it's a weekly shout out. That's his one for today.
I didn't know he owned the podcast. But in general, when you see someone who's that far ahead on an individual lift, that's obviously because of a leverage setup. And in my opinion, they're forever going to have that leverage, right? You don't need to train that lift hard for it to get good, because it obviously is inherently going to be mastered. You want to get some kind of technical mastery in there, but so long as they have a strong core, so long as they continue to train their squat, that deadlift is going to go up. Mm-hmm. So I would put that pretty much on the back burner, and I would focus on bringing up the lifts that they need to do better at. So I would have that person squatting. I would probably even start with squatting three times a week. And again, it depending on what they were using previously and how they were recovering to it. So if they were squatting twice a week, so if you were squatting twice a week and were absolutely just getting destroyed, giving you a third day isn't going to suddenly have you make progress. But if you're squatting twice a week and your max isn't going up and you don't feel really beat up, you could probably take a third day. It doesn't need to be necessarily hard. You know, it could be three sets of 10 on front squats with 60 kilos, but that's 30 repetitions and 3,000 pounds of volume that you weren't doing before. Something like that. So that's a way to add that. So
it was 1800 kilos, but all good.
1800 kilos. So that's about 4,000 pounds actually. The number is,
let's not get bogged down in the details, man.
2.2,
39, 60, I think. Yeah.
It's about 4,000.
give or take.
At a certain age, you just get to, it gets to be acceptable for you to use rounding. I've reached that age.
Yeah.
You're acting like you're like 40.
Everyone thinks I am. I had to start using anti-aging cream on my face.
I was going to say, you got a very youthful glow to your face. You're not doing too badly there. I'm not sure if it's the light of the screen.
We can't see his head.
It's a bit of both. Yeah, I know, the hair. That's why I have this glorious Green Bay Packers hat on, which they actually play their first preseason game tomorrow.
Yeah.
And I'm very excited about it, even though preseason football is shit. But it's I'm just excited to watch the team play.
No, you've got a smooth, wrinkleless forehead that's getting bigger and bigger as your hairline recedes. You look good.
My hairline is not receding.
I don't normally diss, I guess, this hard, I'm going to say.
Yeah, I know. You're really digging in. That's okay. But
you can return fire. It's good.
Most Americans can't take it, but you've done well.
I can handle it. I deal with children all the time. It's fine.
but we're at a new level of immaturity. So you were saying 2 to 3 sessions of squats a week, high frequency bench, low frequency dead.
Yeah, because the technical mastery and the back strength advantage there is very clear. So I would absolutely train the legs substantially. I would have them doing core training all the time, because despite the back being strong, that person probably deadlifts with a round back because they have a long torso and long arms, and they have relatively weak quads, which is why their squat is so much lower than their deadlift. And the long arms contribute to their crappy bench, and so I'm going to make that person train a longer range of motion bench instead of trying to cheat it with a big arch. I'm going to have them try to master building an arch so that once they are actually stronger, we can utilize that. But you'll never escape a ratio like that. If someone has that much of a disparity between their bench and their deadlift and their bench and their squat, you can improve it, absolutely, but you have to keep your rate of progress in mind. Pretty much for the life of that lifter, you can expect to have the best rate of progress on the deadlift, middle on the squat, and worst on the bench because of just how they're built, and it's hard to defeat that.
Do you ever see big disparities like this that aren't to do with leverage and that might be due to technique?
Extremely rare. When you give me an example of someone who can deadlift 280 kilos, that's someone who has been lifting for a bit. I can think of one. No, that's injury related. I can't think of any examples of that, to be honest with you.
So another thing that occurred to me when you were talking, you were talking about getting technical mastery in the squat, but then one of your examples was to use a third day where you might, do a light squat variation, like a front squat. How much carryover in terms of technical mastery do you think you get from variations that aren't very close to the actual competition lift?
Minimal. And the idea behind the addition of that day is not for technical mastery. That's for additional contributing volume to training that motor pattern.
Yeah.
Now, is that going to be superior to performing an additional day of high bar squats, low bar squats, pause squats? Probably not. But in the context of adding an additional day of frequency, I'm generally a proponent of starting with an easy day. And I think you gradually build that day up either in terms of specificity or in terms of overall volume, in terms of overall training demand, as you learn how much you can recover from. And I would rather start with less than start with too much and find out that you need to back off.
Yeah, for sure.
Because this lifter is at different stages in the different lifts, would you periodize the lifts differently from a long-term perspective as well? And would you also peak them at different times?
Maybe. I've had a couple lifters who I've done that with where I'll ramp up their bench for 3 weeks, their squat for 4, and their deadlift for 5 or something like that. That's only for athletes who I've worked with for a long time. Again, I need a kind of a long history of data. We need to have done testing 4 or 5 times or done 3 to 5 meets for me to have had an example to get it wrong and to get it right for me to know that, and so it's in general, I would say typically no, because I don't have the backing data for most people to make those kind of training decisions. But that's the short answer. Typically no.
Okay. What about were somebody's abilities not as disparate as this, but they were better at one lift than another, and one they had a reasonable level of technical mastery and the other they just, lacked a bit of muscle and skill. When things are a little closer together and it's not so much to do with innate ability, how would that influence your practice versus, say, this example?
Well, when you say that, everybody's better at one lift, right? Very few people are totally balanced. You have someone like a Bryce Lewis, who is an extremely balanced elite lifter on all three disciplines, right? But that is uncommon. Typically, people are, a good bencher or a good deadlifter, one or the other, and most people have a decent squat, and that's kind of the universal thing. Most people can either squat and bench, or they can squat and deadlift, generally speaking. There are some extreme outlier examples. You have your Christoph Weersbickies of the world who have the worst squat in their class but win because they have a deadlift so much better than everyone else, right?
Yeah.
Or the your Jennifer Thompsons, whose bench is such an outlier that she's able to make up for having the 4th or 5th best squat and deadlift. But the outside of people like that, I would simply treat them as an average trainee, and I would start them with an approach that suits their maxes and their training experience and their gender.
Sure. How much stock do you put in the idea of capped potential? You've said everybody's always sort of better or worse at one lift. You know, but are there ways of telling whether somebody's just sort of approaching their performance ceiling for one lift as opposed to just being untrained in the others?
You know, that's a good question, and I don't know that I have coached anybody that has made absolutely no progress on lifts for extended periods of time, except for maybe Alex Hayes. But
that's an attitude thing, I think. Lack of moral fiber.
Lack of moral fiber, lack of testicles, bit of both. in general, though, yeah. I would say, you know, if you've tried multiple different training approaches over the past several years and you haven't been able to put 2.5 kilos on your lifts, and you've hired coaches who've given you different approaches, and you've tried a bunch of stuff and you just can't get yourself to make more progress, then maybe you're getting close to the ceiling. But I think so few people actually exhaust all the options and find that. Mm. You know, I think there's always a way you can milk a little more out of the cow. You know, you can use a daily maxing approach, and you can adjust the amount of frequency or the amount of volume that you're doing in your back offs. There's aggressive ways to break through plateaus like that. And I don't know that I buy into the fact that there's a totally hard ceiling. I at the same time, you know, there's a point where you're going to start to damage your connective tissues, and things just, you start to exceed what your body can handle. So I think there's a practical limit, but I just don't know how you would find it.
I think like logically there's a limit to people's abilities, but I'd be very surprised if many people actually get to that limit. And I visualize training and ability sort of as more like an interface, where for a given set of circumstances, you might sort of exhaust your potential, but it's not to say that with, yeah, like you were saying, a different approach, you might reach a peak slightly higher, or, you know, were you to not have done X or Y in the past, you might have gotten a little bit higher. And so sometimes it can take a bit of unwinding or a different approach for you to reach a peak that's higher. It's just somewhere else on that training interface than where you are currently.
You know? Right. And you can always adjust the external factors, right? You can recover better. You can spend more time, you know, and you can eat better. You can reduce your stress. There's so many things that go into it. And there are so few people who are able to optimize all of those factors for an extended period of time, who happen to also be advanced trainees, who have also tried a bunch of different training approaches. In powerlifting, where nobody's making any money for the actual lifting, I think there's probably an extremely, extremely finite, if possibly non-existent, group of people who have gotten there.
Yeah. Let's go back just quickly to this case study and sort of bring it together. So you've inherited this person with the disparate abilities. Let's say you've had them for a few years now, and their squat's starting to fill in its potential a little bit better, and they're getting better at bench as well. Over time, would you reduce the differences in how you train the lifts, or do you think that pattern that you observed of needing less deadlift work and more squat work, say, would be maintained in the long term?
If they maintain a disparity like that between squat and deadlift, I think that, you know, you can continue to train that way. I don't see the need to try to make someone who's extremely good at the deadlift do the deadlift all the time to further master it. You could invest that training volume into improving the squat, which will carry over into their deadlift better, in my opinion, anyway.
Yeah, sure. I think we'll take another very quick break, unless you've got more to add, Alex. All right, and then we've got our 4 questions that tell us everything you need to know about a person. So we'll come back. Weekly Weights. All right, welcome back to Weekly Weights. It's episode 17, where we're here with Hanny, and we've got the 4 questions that tell you everything you need to know about a person. Alex, fire away.
So if you could take one person to dinner, dead or alive, who would it be and why?
Ooh, that is a good question. Maybe I should have known this before so I could have thought of an answer, a better answer.
Know.
I fucking know what I said. for anyone listening, I was given the opportunity to hear these questions beforehand, so you get to hear some dead air here, as I think. You know,
it was like he wanted people to know the real me. Like he wanted us to go on a journey of discovery together.
Yeah, exactly. Who would I want to get dinner with? That's an extremely hard question, but I think the answer right now has to be Anthony Bourdain.
Who's Anthony Bourdain?
Anthony Bourdain is a chef and a famous food writer who had a couple of TV shows that were hugely popular in the US. He had a history of depression and drug problems and actually just committed suicide like a month ago, and or maybe a little more than a month ago. If you don't know who he is, he did a show called No Reservations and a show called something unknown, Parts Unknown. And basically he would go to different places in the world and where a typical travel show will go and show you the sights and talk about, you know, this and that, he would go and experience cultures and places by way of eating with them. And as someone who is a huge lover of food and just a general watcher of his show, I watched it with my parents not my whole childhood, but while it was on. And I always loved his work. And that was something that really hit close to home with myself and with a lot of my friends, because we all kind of grew up watching Anthony Bourdain. You know, it's almost like I've eaten in Thailand because I've seen him eat the street food out there. And, you know, that really was, I think, a loss to the world. And he was quite young. He was only in his 50s or early 60s. And he took his own life just very recently.
And if you do go to Thailand, don't eat the street food in Thailand.
Anthony said it was okay, though.
Don't do it.
All right, we have question number two, Alex.
By the way, I thought you were going to say Aaron Rodgers.
I would love to eat with Aaron Rodgers, but Aaron Rodgers is alive and well, and you know, I can make that happen in the future if I really put my mind to it.
All right, question number two.
Who is your favorite athlete of all time?
Oh, well, I mean,
Alex.
No, absolutely not. That's disgusting. He's closer to the bottom of the list than the top. Closer to the bottom of the list than the top. Also, powerlifters are.
By the way.
Not a person I coach. I know. I knew what you meant. That is tough.
Yeah.
Yeah. This is cliche, but I have to give the answer of Aaron Rodgers.
Good answer.
The guy is a surgeon with a football, and he's just such a pleasure to watch. I have been extremely fortunate to have been a Packers fan since the Brett Favre era, and I've been extremely fortunate as a fan to see two Hall of Fame quarterbacks back to back. And there's nobody slinging the ball better than him. So.
Sorry, I'm quite ignorant of football. Who was the Hall of Fame quarterback before that?
Brett Favre.
His name was Brett Favre.
Brett Favre.
Very different style of play, but...
Right.
Roethlisberger plays for Pittsburgh.
Yeah, but didn't Roethlisberger or whatever play for Green Bay in like 2011?
No.
No?
No, he's never played for Green Bay. Not to my knowledge, anyway, unless he was originally drafted by them, but I don't think he was.
No, probably not. I've only got the very faintest knowledge of football, as you can probably tell. Question number three is, which movie or television character are you most like?
Ooh, Conan the Barbarian.
Just the physique or?
No, everything but the physique. No, that's tough. Have you seen Hot Fuzz?
Yeah.
Simon Pegg's character in Hot Fuzz, probably.
Have you seen Hot Fuzz? Yeah.
So, you know, good sense of humor, generally quite bitter and negative. That's pretty much me.
That sums you up quite well.
Mm.
Yeah, how crazy is there's the coincidence between like comedians and having depression? And I remember hearing somebody say really insightfully, it's kind of like people with depression have incredible skills of observation. They kind of see to the core of things, and part of comedy is like observation and sort of like commenting on reality. And so you almost wonder if like part of why they're so funny is because they're able to be so incisive and comment on patterns that probably come, you know, go under the radar for you, but it's also part of what makes them depressed. You ever thought of that?
You're saying that Handy has depression?
Oh, maybe from coaching you, but I reckon he's slowly repressing the trauma.
That's fair.
I don't know.
I mean, you've smirked once or twice over the course of this discussion.
I do occasionally crack a smile that I try to hide from the public.
Yeah, it was a very smug smile when you corrected me for using a bad example once. I saw that. It's kind of like you almost wanted to cover it with your hand. You're like, look at this idiot from Australia. Had backwater. Mate, we're speaking our second language here.
I'm aware you're just speaking a slightly inferior version of English.
Yeah, mate. We're both a few roos short of a paddock. You know that phrase?
No. But I imagine I can put it together. Kangaroos, paddock, I get it.
Yeah. All right. couple of beers short of a slab. All right. The last question is that your life's being made into a montage. What's the music?
Oh, easy. Eye of the Tiger.
You know, we've actually had that response twice or who three times. That? Jules definitely said that.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
You got to say something else then.
Yeah, you got to think of something else that's been taken.
Oof. Kashmir by Led Zeppelin.
Very good.
Yeah, that's a good one. A bit more exotic than Eye of the Tiger.
Yeah, yeah, and it's a bit more dramatic.
It's longer too, which is optimistic.
Yeah,
it's
yeah,
twice
well, yeah.
As long.
I like to think I could live for at least another 3 to 5 minutes.
There's 3 to 5 minutes worth of highlights though that you need really if you're going to extend the montage. Unless your montage is just very droney and you know one of those like finger against a rainy window sad montages.
Well, yeah. Have you guys seen the movie? Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy.
I have, yeah. My like parents to used to call me Marvin the Paranoid Android, actually.
I'm the robot. Yeah.
Yeah, Marvin.
Oh, that would be nice. And then he just puts his head down in depression, you know? A bit like Eeyore from, what was it, Winnie the Pooh?
Yeah,
Eeyore the depressed donkey?
The donkey, yeah.
Depressed donkey. Oh, my God. All right, so we've now gotten like 4 bonus movie characters out of that as well. Okay, thank you so much for joining us, mate. Couple of things very quickly before we get you to sing us out or give us a poem out.
I will not sing a song.
Okay, number one, where can we find you on the internet or for people who want to put in a coaching inquiry?
Oh, definitely. The easiest way to get a hold of me is going to be via direct message on Instagram. But if you send me a direct message on Instagram, I'm just going to tell you to email me. So my Instagram, though, is at Hanny, H-A-N-I, _TSA. And my email is Hanny, H-A-N-I, @thestrengthathlete.com. Those are the absolute easiest ways to get a hold of me. And I wouldn't recommend anything else because those are the easiest and I'm always checking those things.
Hanny, I got a funny story. Back when you were coaching.
Oh, that's funny. No, oh, no, go ahead.
We'll cut that out.
I'm loving having just a third party rag on Alex because I'm normally going it alone. Like, it's a one-man crusade
like
normally.
You'll like this. You'll like
all right, I'm ready.
Back when you were coaching me, I would always tag you and stuff. And I had this one client who used to follow you and always watch your videos and stuff. And once he said to me, bro, your coach Hanny Sar is really strong.
Hanny Sar, that's right.
I thought it was an Asian guy with the last name Sar or what?
Yeah, he thought your last name was Sar.
Shout out to Derek. Shout out to Derek.
I remember that actually. That's very funny.
Shout out to Derek. That's not my last name. It's in my profile. My last name is in my profile. It's there.
It's harder to pronounce if possible than name that's 2/3 consonants. All right. So final job for you. You can either sing us a song or you can tell us, you know, give us a little poem or something, but this is gonna be your outro music, I think.
He's going to hang up the call for sure.
Weekly Waits, the podcast. Alex, Will, homosexuals, refrigerator.
All right, that's Weekly Waits, a haiku. Okay, thanks so much for joining us, Annie. We'll chat to you guys next week. See you later. I woke up this morning. I went to the gym. We called up Annie so that speak to him on Weekly Waits. Hanny on Weekly Waits.